love to hear the whistle blow. She's taking the sun and leaving the rain and making me wanna go. I've got the blues, longing for her company. It's many miles from where I am to the only one for me. It's so lonesome here, waiting for the manifest. I hope that engineer is kind enough to let me be his guest. Good old pal to me. Take me everywhere I want to go. Get my transportation free.
This is Dave Monk, Barry Monk, WAFT, Champaign, 90.1 on your FM dial.
Dave on the board. Today is December 20th, 2015. And as always, this is a program about environmentalism and how it affects us and how we can affect it.
So I want to say something about the farmer's market. Find it to be very friendly and extensive. The malls were full of active vendors, and I like to get storylines. If I buy something, I like to know who did it and perhaps something about the item that I buy. Craftspeople don't always have a vita or a record of what they do and what their philosophy is. The most degreed artists usually have a vita that is helpful. So I talk to people about what they do and why, and sometimes I find that they have very interesting backgrounds, and crafts may or may not be their second job, but it's their careers have been very interesting. I have to warn you, you can't stand in front of somebody's craft area and take space when and block sales. So you have to be very careful and back out if somebody arrives. But that's manageable and understandable. I give you some examples of the sorts of things that I find interesting. I talk to man with spoons. He's a retiree from the University of Illinois, but for years he's been remodeling forks and spoons, and is very creative. He's also an environmentalist, and when we talked about the Kickapoo Trail, he had canoed under the large bridge on the Vermilion River, and so we had a friendly discussion. I talked to somebody about computers and what they were doing with computers, and they were doing research on flight lines where winds and certain areas of flight lines get to be a challenge. So I was reminded that my niece is a skydiver, and they often come from Australia to Los Angeles to experiment with wind tunnels, and something of the same problem exists on runways. So, as a husband and wife that make spiders, and so I talked to them for a while, and they were from Minnesota, and so I asked them if they were Scandinavian. No, they were from Prussian German, and they were here because the husband got a job as a professor of vegetable science, and this is what they were doing in retirement. The woodcarver was there with interesting shavings, so we had a discussion about the use of shavings as mulch. There's a lot of cellulose in wood shavings, and they can be used to prevent the growth of weeds, but they're not fertilizers. They're not easily broken down by microorganisms, and if you expect them to be broken down by microorganisms, then that takes those microorganisms from other organic jobs. But some of the burls and things that are turned are tremendously interesting because they give you an idea of the grain, and it's if it's a bowl, it's from every which ways. And just a little statement that says that burls are on most trees. They're a result of disturbance or irritation of the tree, and they grow out as a big lump and often have small shoots on them, so that grain, when you turn down a burl, is very interesting. Might be caused by an insect or one log rubbing against another, or something to do with an axe blaze or something like that. But just the information is interesting. The berry man was there with autumn olives, and that we had a discussion there because he had been out to Heartland Pathways at Monticello and collected autumn olives there. We're faced with this rather invasive tree, and it, after a number of years, it gets to be very productive of olives. They're small olives, but you spread canvas underneath it, a mature tree, and the olives can be collected on that canvas when you knock the stems or shake them, and they can be converted into preserves and sold. That removal of olives helps us because otherwise we have a gazillion of seeds invading our prairie, and what happens with the autumn olives is that they shade out the prairie. So that's helpful. There was the bottle lady on the corner, comes from Danville, and she takes liquor bottles and works them into artwork, and they sell well. And but a little conversation, and she has had a challenge of a lot of rain in Danville, and some of her activities have been inundated. Just little pieces of information that you exchange, and it lets you know who's who. And sometimes you can send a little piece of information with something that you're giving to another person. Carrie, the apple lady, is has holdover stock. So this is the last farmer's market. So does she have cold storage? No. So she has been distributing some of her materials, vegetables especially, to other agencies mostly. Different groups that are around town that distribute food. Apples will stay over, but tomatoes won't. So that is something that you have to think about. There will be one or two indoor farmers markets until the outside market is restored. So that will continue. Kim, the bee man, will be, and Honey, he will be away on the 9th, which is the next farmer's market. So we might just fill in for him at that point. So I just find just mooching around the farmer's market very good. I have spent time selling art prints there and found that very successful too. I can't do that outside very easily because the dust gets onto the prints and scratches them. And wind blows too, and rain gets there. So you're a little more exposed when you're outside. So I have been... I want to change the topic now to Australian Christmas. But in the meantime, let's say that this is Dave Monk, Prairie Monk, and we talk about environmental issues, and that's often what I'm talking about at the farmer's market. The Australian Christmas is in the southern hemisphere. It's hot, 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 and it's almost in monsoonal area. We're at the bottom, the edge of the monsoonal area. So in January, especially, you're likely to get rain and a lot of inches of rain. We lived in below a mountain, and that mountain would get at least 80 inches of rain a year. So it's quite a lot of rain. And the soils are not that good. They've been underneath the ocean, so they're not likely to absorb a lot of the water. It runs off, so you have waterfalls everywhere. We could count like 14 waterfalls on the mountain that we looked at near to us. So there's no Yuletide fires because it's a time of the year when fires are likely to start spontaneously with lightning or with careless lighting of fires. And we go down to the river and get a sheoak, which is not a pine tree, but it looks like a pine tree and it simulates for same. The Christmas decorations harken back to Europe with decorations, candles, and simulated snow in the form of cotton wool and sprays on windows to simulate snow. Not everyone does that. A lot of Australians have a very Australian Christmas and don't harken back to the European background, but Santa Claus is there and the atmosphere is there. We would put a tree on the veranda and all the presents underneath and decorations. We were on a hill. The back door was at grade level. The front of the house was about 7 feet off the ground, with a considerable stairway to come up into the front door. My father was a school teacher, one school teacher, and the school was across the road. We would be hot and willing to go swimming if you got the chance, but the theory was that you should not go swimming on a full stomach because you might get cramps and drown. So people would wait a couple of hours before they, after a meal, before they went swimming. We had various spots. It depends a little on the river. If it's kind of rocky and gravelly, that's different from a sandy river. We would often have a swing attached to a high, substantial branch of a eucalyptus tree or something like that, and you'd take the swing and swing out over the river, and then if you were knowledgeable, you could do two or three somersaults before you went into the pool. You'd be careful doing that. The better proponents would move into the water with very little disturbance of the water. It's a little bit like diving. So you're diving off a swing. And neophytes were not quite so good at that and would end up belly flopping, and that was kind of painful. But they shortly got the idea that swings were part of swimming activities. Some evil-minded types would find a couple of decent-sized stone and they'd crack them under the water. And if you haven't had that happen to you, it sends a rumble through your stomach. And so those people get chased down after a while, but they're always there, willing to create a little disturbance. I'm looking at my notes. There's always people who would swim for a while and then go walk in the woods. The woods in Australia are very interesting. They're a dry area. Most of the soils have been under the ocean for many years, and there are little dillwinias and all sorts of other plants that can survive in a dry area. And they're very small flowers, but very interesting. My parents had a house in an area like that, and they had an English garden, and my mother was English, but we kept about a third of the property in native plants, just because they were interesting. So people would wander around in the woods, and they're very open woods. The eucalypts are not tall and thin. They're sort of curly and not very good for wood, but they survive on minimal land. And you can find insects there. The cicadas are everywhere, and there are many different varieties of cicadas. There are also cicada eaters that will go out and get a cicada. They're wasps, and they have a sort of set of tunnels, and they go out and get a cicada that's probably three times their size and bring it back to their burrows, and they paralyze the cicada so it still lives. I think they may lay their eggs in the cicada, but it remains alive enough for the larva to get out and have food available on the spot. And we always found it interesting to go watch the cicadas being brought in, and it was sort of colonial. It's interesting that there is some discussion about ants and wasps and bees, and there is no leadership in these colonies. They seem to get along with in nature, doing their thing without necessarily having to have a leadership. So there's some discussion in human circles as to whether we should have something more like that, and a very loose sort of leadership. But we would watch. And when I went to school, I couldn't go to high school locally, so I would go to, I was at a boarding school in that area. The rivers were flowing through very sandy areas, and that's where the wasps would be. And so at a boarding school, we weren't supposed to go independently swimming in the river. If you went as a sports event, and you were there with supervisors, but always we were willing to sneak out and swim in the rivers. But we would never wear our clothes, because if you got caught with wet swimmers, you were in for detention for quite a while. So, but the locals seemed to be able to handle that, and the students would enjoy, and the locals would enjoy, and sometimes the students would follow young folk who are lovers and the like, and be a little obnoxious, but that was part of the event. So going back to Christmas, we would have relatives and friends come from the city, near to Sydney. Well, we were like 350 miles from Sydney, but they would come for the vacation. And it was kind of different for them, because this was a little village with a store and one gas pump and an outdoor telephone booth and a phone lines that included lines where several people would be on the same line, and you had your particular ring. There was a hall and a school and a church that was used by several different denominations. You were at the base of a mountain where earth plates were moving, and so you have up the coast of Australia a great divide or a mountain, and that catches the wind that comes across from the Indian Ocean, comes right across Australia and still has some moisture in it, and so as it rises up, it falls on that escarpment, and we lived below the escarpment where there were rivers that ran off that mountain and ran out across a 40-mile coastal plain. Sometimes there was not that much coastal plain, but this coastal plain had enough alluvium coming off of those mountains where it was a little bit of a volcanic activity that the alluvium was quality enough to run dairying, mainly dairying, and mixed farming. That would be something that we would introduce our friends to. We would take the 1928 Whippet up the road that paralleled the river and crossed it at times, mostly a dirt road, mostly rattly bridges that were put together with cross planks that made that sort of noise that allowed you to recognize when a vehicle was coming. Often you went down and across the river at a low level, and that meant that at flood time you couldn't get across the river. So we often had visitors that had come down from the Dorrigo Mountain and stayed with us, and we developed a lot of friendships with those people and kept contact for years. Sometimes they were botanists, sometimes they were just traveling people. One of them taught us how to catch eels and how to fillet eels and catfish, and those catfish and eels became part of our diet. Some of the trucks that came down the hill were coming from the mountains where there was rainforests, and I hesitate to say, but the Australians were no different from anyone else. They took down their rainforests and picked out the trees that they wanted for coach work and building, and burned the rest. But those trucks would come down the hill, and to go across the river, they would have to go down to the bridge at a low level, now been replaced by a high-level bridge. It doesn't block the traffic in flood time. But you could hear the trucks revving up across the bridge, rattle, 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 and then up the hill, and they didn't always make it. So an assistant would have to get out and put a block behind the wheels. And so then the truck would rev up and go about 2 feet and then move the block, and gradually you'd get up to the hill, and then you'd be on the crest, and that would be the most difficult piece of road to negotiate between Dorrigo on the mountains and usually Urunga or Repton. These were places on the river. There was river traffic. Some of this timber would go into making coastal steamers. They didn't have very good access. Sometimes you had to make a waterway, some sort of embankment, and sometimes the trestles that were supporting the truck access and rail access were loaded, but people would have to get into a basket, and a crane would have to lift them onto the trestle. But those trucks came fairly regularly. My father had a small farm associated with his school. There was a commons nearby. Australians have stock routes, and when you didn't have trucks to move cattle to market, you used stock routes. Those stock routes were intermittently provided with a commons where you could take your cattle and leave them overnight, and so we could use the commons, because by the time we were there, most cattle were taken out by truck and the commons were obsolete, but they were still owned by the community, and so we would have the cattle that we had probably about 10 cattle, and they would graze also on the roadside. So after school, we would have to go find the cattle and bring them back. Sometimes they came back by themselves. we would take visitors up the river to the headwaters, and at the headwaters there was sclerophyll forest. It was forest that got enough water and enough nutriment from the mountains around that they grew tall, very tall. And forests will grow tall when they're dense because they're climbing to the sun. And those forests were loaded with tropical birds, birds of paradise, parrots. Sometimes if you went to a place that was sclerophyll forest, you would find you would hardly be able to talk to each other because there was so much noise between birds. Mostly parrots, but every so often we would visited by tropical rainforest birds, often birds of paradise with long and interesting tails and very colorful. We also had a group of local birds, wrens and woolly wagtails and swallows, and we got to know them pretty well. And swallows would always alight on the linen lines along the veranda and make a mess underneath. The woolly wagtails would be nesting under the rafters, but they would always defecate out over the garden, and they were very tidy. The little wrens weighed about nothing, but they came, and my father would sit there at breakfast time and flip them breadcrumbs. And if we left the breakfast table unattended for any while, they would be up on the table and they would make for the butter and other things that they also liked. We had a greenhouse with epiphytes in it. So epiphytes are ferns that live in trees and on rocks, and they have interesting roots that absorb water from the air and also nutriment from the air. The epiphyte roots are more or less a haustoria that grabs onto something and holds the plant in place, but the nutriment is coming through those roots. And so you can take those plants and put them on a suitable substrate in your greenhouse, and they're very, very interesting. So my father created a huge greenhouse, and that was wonderful. My mother had a bench of maidenhair ferns and other interesting ferns just near our breakfast table, and she had a little green frog that made interesting sounds, but she would take tepid water and dribble it over the frog, and the frog would wash its face with its front paw and really enjoy it. So, but we had other frogs. Over the back door, there would be up to 18 big green frogs. They seemed to all be able to get along with each other. When it rained, they blew themselves up. This is a way of dropping onto the floor without hurting yourself, is to have a body full of air, and then when you fall, it exhausts, so you can hear this air being released as the frog jumps down and finds its way to the tanks. We didn't have laid on water. We had 1,000-gallon tanks that took water off the roof. And so they would climb up on top of the roof and spend their night catching mosquitoes and other insects. Then they would return to the top of the door, and we would enjoy their company. Sometimes we would have lizards. We had several lizards that we got along with,
and we had to watch because our hot water came from a tub that was heated each day, and if the lizard got too close to the copper, then that was not good for the lizard. So, but we could also feed the lizards things, and we had a chicken run, and we had a big lizard there. That was a goanna, about 4 feet long, and they come in various sizes. They have a big fat belly, and they can climb trees, but they can also climb into your chicken run nests and eat the eggs. And it's rather interesting to watch a goanna eat an egg with a forky tongue. It has to break the egg open. And so we also had hawks, and if you weren't careful, the hawks would take your chickens, especially young chickens. So we had to have that sort of protection. The toilets were outdoors. They were pit toilets, so when one pit was full, you moved it, and then you grew a grapefruit tree on the remainder, and the grapefruit produced very nice grapefruit. We didn't have any pigs, but we'd had chickens and we had cows, and they became our friends. We also had a dog named Hermes, and it would spend its life about 2 inches behind my father and sitting right next to him. So he was the family dog. At tropical time, when the monsoons came, we were on the tail end of the monsoons, but you could have very serious flooding. So sometimes we had to go rescue people that were marooned in their house on the bottomlands, or salvage beehives and things like that. We had snakes, and you didn't lift up a board or a piece of iron without you looked for the snakes underneath. Most of them were relatively small, up to about 4 feet long. Some of them were rather poisonous, and you got to know their characteristics. Some were python-type snakes that might be 15 feet long. A next-door neighbor saw one climbing up an orange tree, and that snake had lots of lumps in it, and each lump was a chicken. So the snake had found the chicken yard. Usually farmers like to keep those sorts of snakes and take them to a set of rabbit warrens. Rabbits were introduced into Australia as animals to be hunted, and once they escaped, they became a national pest because there were no native predators. And so the Australians have spent countless money putting in rabbit-proof fences, and then the rabbits burrow under them, and then they've invented a myxomatosis, which is a disease carried by mosquitoes that gets into rabbits, and that reduced the population dramatically, but then the rabbits got resistant to that disease. So it's, rabbits are still a problem in Australia. We had orchards. We had our own local orchard. I can remember when the Governor General came past, all the school children were lined up at an appropriate corner near the bridge, and we had donated him a basket full of naval oranges that were, you know, almost 6 inches across. We were proud of doing that. He always remembered Thora because all the kids had no shoes on. And we didn't do shoes. We ran around barefooted. But those little events happened every once in a while. The orchard we had a counterpart where two immigrant Eastern Europeans, Mr. Kornt and Mr. Pletsky, had a formal orchard and a nice, neat little sales unit, and they lived there in a house. And we would go buy oranges, pomelos. Pomelos have a very thick skin. They're used to provide pectin, so if you're making jam, it helps to thicken the jam. There were Chinese gooseberries, which these days have been called kiwis. And I find out that that's because kiwis are a flightless bird in New Zealand, and when they roll themselves up and sort of bury themselves in a little burrow, they just look like the outside of a kiwi that you can buy in the shop. So the name was appropriate and probably had something to do with the sales mechanism. Kiwi might be easier to handle and advertise than Chinese gooseberry. But there were vines that were about 6 feet over your head, and perhaps not that high, but they were very generous with their fruiting. We would buy passion fruit. Sometimes you went in and you picked the things yourselves and then got them adjudicated. We can do the same thing here with orchards. Every once in a while we would go to the ocean, to a beach. My father had a background in ministry, so he would sometimes act as a locum or a temporary parson at a church where someone was on vacation. And so we would go to the beach at the same time. The Australian beaches, there's a coastal plain, which is fairly brief, and then it goes down into deep water. But there was the beach, and then there was the river that ran behind. The Bellinger River ran out to the ocean. So you could boat there as well as swim, and you could tumble and enjoy climbing sand dunes and sliding down side to side. Sand dunes have a physical characteristic according to the type of sand that is there, and it has a certain fall, and the wind provides that physics, and you can start at the top of a sand dune and slide down to the bottom. Then you have to climb your way back up. And there are plants that stabilize those sand dunes, and there's an ecology there that is interesting. Just as in the river, you might find a wasp, then you would find the counterpart. And out in the water, you would find mangroves and a whole another ecosystem. When we went to the coast, we went by rolling hills, and it was beautiful enough that it was attractive to artists to sit there and paint the mountains in the background. One of the very famous painters that would do that was named Gruner, and it's almost one hill where Gruner would do his painting. some of the lumber would go to the mouth of the river at Urunga and be loaded onto coastal steamers and sent to Sydney, the nearest major local city. When we went to the coast and to beaches, we had to be careful to come back home, because cattle that are used to being milked at a certain time of day get very upset with you if you are not there to milk them at the right time. And if you arrive late, you can almost see them being upset with you. So we would be careful to come back. My father was a teacher at a one-teacher school, and that meant that sometimes you only had 14 students, sometimes you had 35 or 50. If the road up the mountain was being repaired, then you had a lot of students all at once. All the classes were in one room, and so everyone overheard everyone else, and sometimes senior students would be able to help junior students on their way up. When it rained, you had to disperse your classes quickly, because some would be on little streams and rivulets that would flood within the hour, and the walkways across those streams would be flooded. They usually kept a boat on one side so that you could get across if necessary, but flooded streams are not easy to negotiate with flat-bottom boats. They are hard to negotiate with, so it's better that they get across their planks to their small farm or home before a storm. So that was always part of things. The students would arrive about 9 o'clock, and my father had a brake drum hanging on from the ceiling, and a hammer, and that was the bell to announce the start of the school day, and a little assembly outside, and the people would come in and take their seats in long benches, not individual seats. And so we used to boil our clothes in a copper, and so washing day was usually Monday, and we would have two tubs and a wringer in between, and so the boiled up clothes would be put through the wringer and hung out to dry. You had to be careful if you had a young calf, a potty calf, that was being weaned from its mother. Those calves have what is called a suck potential, and they would latch onto something on the linen line and suck it as if it was their mother's teat. But it would ruin the piece of laundry that was there. So we always had to be careful that the calves didn't have access to the linen line. So I went to boarding school, and that was because it would have taken me half a week to get to a high school locally, and so going to a boarding school was interesting. It was an all-male school. Australia has got five major cities, and that's where most of the population is. The rest of the continent is fairly sparsely populated, and most of the farming is on the east coast, where there's rainfall. So the students at an agricultural college that I went to were from various places. Some were from the coastal areas, some were from the inland areas where the farming was more likely to be sheep and cattle and wheat. As with here in Oklahoma, people tended to take their agriculture further west than they should have, so they got down into 12 inches of rain and 10 inches of rain, and perhaps at not the right time of the year, and so the crops would be ineffective, and the soil would be disturbed, and we would have dust storms. So that sort of thing stopped. But we also have rainfall that falls on the mountains and runs east to the Pacific Ocean very quickly, whereas the rivers that run west to the Australian Bight are slow-moving and not very well supplied with water. So one of the aims of the Australian engineers has been to put dams on the east coast of the mountains and channel it through the mountain and provide irrigation water to the west, and at the same time generate hydroelectricity from the fall of that water. So we do have inland waters, the Murrumbidgee, the Murray, and the Darling Rivers. But when you have a drought, those rivers become small swamplands and not connected. So it's a part of Australian inland being fairly dry. Those slopes on the other side of the mountain, nearer to the coast, but on the west side of the mountains, still receive enough rainfall that you can have fat lamb raising and crops, not corn and soybeans so much, but as more like wheat and oats. We grew up with horses, and I've plowed fields with horses and a single furrow plow. We would know the difference between a Clydesdale and a Percheron and their temperaments, and they would be the draft horses that you see today in Amish country. You would also have riding horses, and you would have ponies that could corral cattle and sheep. And those ponies were very good and very intelligent. And if you were a neophyte and got on one of those ponies and a cow got to move out of the corral, then the pony with on its own volition would move very quickly and at almost at right angles. If you weren't very careful, you went over the head of the pony. And it was just doing what it was taught to do. But also, if you go to open a gate, you had to bend down and open the gate quickly because the pony was used to going through the gate quickly, and if you didn't move appropriately, he just left you behind on the gate, more or less. So sheep raising is a different thing. When I was doing agriculture, we spent about a year of time on vacation time, working with various agricultural inputs. And for a time I worked with a sheep property, and it was for wool, but mostly it was for sheep that were English breeds or mixed breeds that could be used for mutton too. So you have various ages of sheep. You have lambs. You have regular mutton sheep and older sheep that are referred to as crackers. They're probably 5 or 6 years old. They have probably been providing wool. So you have a wool shed, and you bring the sheep into the wool shed, and you hope it doesn't rain. The wool shed is built on stilts so that the sheep can be underneath the wool shed. Then you have usually a flying group of shearers that come in. You have someone that brings in the sheep, you have a board with several shearing stands there, and you have a system for shearing your sheep. You take a belly blow first, and then you go around the belly and go through the shoulders, and you do that so that you can end up with the fleece all in one piece. The fleece then goes to you have a pickup person that throws the fleece onto a grid so that a professional wool classer can class that wool. If it's a merino and very fine crimps, then it's worth more than, say, a Lincoln or a sheep that has very big crimps, perhaps an inch apart. So that would be more a mutton sheep. So the wool classer, first of all, takes out the weeds and seeds the pizzle areas and folds that up, and that is baled and sent to places like Sydney where it is auctioned. I'm watching the clock. I think we've got 3 minutes. The sheep that are shorn are very pleased to be shorn. They move out of that shed with lots of jumps. And you then also have to be careful that it doesn't rain and they get cold because they've lost their furry coat. And dogs are very helpful in this whole management. They can do things like run around on top of sheep and catch ones that are out of order. And so the Australian sheepdog is well known as a wunderkind. But I think we're saying, this is Dave Monk, your Prairie Monk, WEFT Champagne. And Merry Christmas to you. And we'll be back later.
And Dave and the board, yes, we'll see you one more time before the new year. As always, the views and opinions expressed are solely those of the speakers and nobody else. Two quick bits of station business you should know about. First of all, if you have a vehicle that you have the title for, and whether it runs or not, you just are interested in getting it off your hands, you can help WEFT by donating it, and a group will come and pick up the car, and they'll sell it, and WEFT gets almost all of the proceeds from that. They're called the Center for Car Donations. Even though it's called Car Donations, they actually take motorboats and RVs and motor scooters, as long as it has a motor in it. Even if the motor doesn't work, they're interested. So you can contact them at 877-411-3662. Tell them you've got a vehicle and make sure to mention WEFT. And then again, after the sale goes through, WEFT gets at least 80% of the sale value of that vehicle. Again, you need to have the title. Again, it doesn't need to be running. It just has to have had a motor in it. And again, that phone number to call, 877-411-3662. Also, it's the end of the year, and WEFT has what we're calling Vision 2020. We're changing things around here. You'll notice over time as we change things, and we can really use your support. How do you make that support? How do you contribute to WEFT? Simple. Go to our website, weft.org/support, and that's the page where you can make an online donation to help WEFT. Every penny helps. Of course, we are tax deductible, so that will help you on your taxes. And one more time, the place to go to make that donation online, weft.org/support. And it's now noon, time for Shruti Music of India. Oh, and I forgot to turn on the theme song. Oh, the music as we go. How about we get just a couple of seconds of
of Joel Mabus as we head